1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 135, LDS Church Growth and Changing Conceptions of Lineage and Race, a paper by Armin Moss.
Yes, they've had, as I understand it, they've had 8 children, and there are approximately 5 in the Southern California area where he's moved, and that's probably one of the main motivations of retiring and moving to Southern California from Pullman, Washington. So Armin has had a long and distinguished career as a sociologist at the university level, of course, and also as a Mormon active participant of church history and sociology. In fact, he's recently the president of the Mormon History Association, and I heard him speak a little over a year ago in Washington, D.C., when he gave the president's address, the retiring president's address. And for those who are interested, the written version's in the Journal of Mormon History. I think it's available here at a slightly reduced rate. It's called In Search of Ephraim, Traditional Mormon Conceptions of Lineage and Race. And it's a very detailed and lengthy treatise and very interesting. I was thoroughly immersed when I started reading it, and there's some other good articles in this Journal of Mormon History here also. There's one by a good friend of Armin's at the University of Washington, Rodney Stark, on the extracting social scientific models from Mormon history. And you who have taken Newsweek and other magazines this year know that Rodney also has been quoted quite extensively concerning Christianity and concerning the Mormon Church. Now, Armin received his doctorate from the University of California at Berkeley. And it was during the 60s when he was there, I understand. And I remember it very well because at that time I was working for NASA at Moffett Field, California. And we were in the process of putting a man on the moon. And there was a rush with the Russians. And here was Armin up at the University of California at Berkeley where the kids were raising all Billy Heck, you know, and there were a few people up in San Francisco that were kind of against the mainstream and the establishment, and I'm not sure what the influence this had on the social outlook of my good friend Armin, but at any rate, he succeeded and got a doctorate from the University of California at Berkeley, which was the enemy, essentially, but essentially also of the university where I went to school at Stanford. So I have a great admiration for Armin, and I'm going to let him take as much time as there's allotted here and not say anything more about him, except that I think we're very fortunate to have somebody in the church that has brought some of these issues to the forefront in this article and in what he's going to mention today. It's not surprising to any of us that in the past as now, the authorities of the church are not always in agreement with some of the doctrines, and some of the areas are rather in doubt. And so without further ado, let's give a welcome hand to Armin Moss.
Thanks, Lee, for your generous introduction. We were informed only recently that the commentator selected for this session is unable to appear, which means that you're basically stuck with me for most of the time. And unaccustomed as I am to brevity, that could be a problem. But I prepared as though there were a commentator before I knew there wasn't going to be one. And I've confined myself to a written text that is somewhat well-timed, so I believe there will be some time left over for audience discussion afterward, and perhaps 15 minutes or 20. I'll do my best, and I prefer that anyway to commentators. And I want to thank Lee for plugging the Journal of Mormon History, not just the issue with my article in it, but it's a good journal. I'd like to say by way of preface that this paper presents an overview and summary of a book manuscript now in preparation. The book is tentatively entitled All Abraham's Children, subtitled Changing Mormon Conceptions of Lineage and Race. It will be, expect to submit the manuscript later this year to the University of Illinois Press. So this is an overview of a work in progress, and I will naturally welcome input from people, critical and otherwise, about the work in progress. In general, this work is a study of the evolution and development of religious ideas in response to practical experience. In particular, it is a study of the development of LDS ideas about race and lineage in light of changing experiences with proselyting and church growth in different parts of the world. Specifically, I'm proposing a retrospective and prospective theoretical construction of the history of LDS ideas, according to which racialist religious conceptions, and especially extra-canonical doctrines, have evolved in response to differential missionizing success in various places across time. More incidentally, at a spiritual and moral level, my work is a study of the long process by which the Church's commitment to converting the world to its message of the restored gospel has concomitantly brought about a refinement and purification in the Church's own understanding of that gospel of universal brotherhood. At last year's Sunstone Symposium, I summarized a segment of this work, which is the one just published in the Journal of Mormon History. That segment dealt with the process by which Mormonism acquired a general racialist framework for interpreting both the history and destiny of the Latter-day Saints. For about a century after the arrival of the Saints in Utah, an ideological movement promoted by certain powerful church leaders and their allies eclipsed the universalism of the gospel taught by the Apostle Paul. This new movement synthesized a certain understanding of the doctrine of preexistence with two fashionable intellectual currents imported from outside Mormonism, namely British Israelism and Anglo-Saxon triumphalism. This construction of church doctrine provided an elaborate basis for the claim that 19th century Mormons were virtually all literal descendants of one of the ancient tribes of Israel, particularly the tribe of Ephraim, a royal lineage with a special divine mandate and destiny. This same doctrinal framework offered an implicit rank ordering of other lineages according to presumed divine favor. Close after Ephraim came Manasseh, including, of course, the Lamanites. Then came Judah, or the Jews, then the rest of the Israelite tribes, then the rest of Abraham's descendants, insofar as these could be known, then the Gentiles, and finally, at the bottom, the seed of Cain and Ham, manifested through black African lineage. As I said, such a rank ordering was only implicit in LDS discourse. Nobody articulated that rank ordering. But anyone growing up Mormon in my generation, or that of my children, I think, certainly was exposed to that kind of discourse in lesson manuals and in authoritative church books. Certainly as late as 1970, survey data that I collected from representative samples of Mormons in Salt Lake City and San Francisco showed that most Mormons still believed themselves to be literal descendants of Ephraim or other Israelite tribes, and thus God's chosen people, displacing the Jews. In my recent published Journal of Mormon History article, I have traced the rise of these doctrines about Ephraimite and other lineages, as well as their eventual disappearance from general church discourse, although, to be sure, a residue of such racialist teaching still remains in print. In that Journal of Mormon History article, I draw upon widely understood theories in social psychology about the formation of group identities to argue that this racialist construction of Mormon ethnic identity functioned in large part as a defensive ideology to counter the pervasive 19th century image of Mormons as a pariah people. This ideology also developed in tandem with the massive numbers of conversions enjoyed by the church in England, Scandinavia, and Germany during the 1830s through at least the 1870s. Given both the theological framework of Mormonism and the increasingly popular racialist explanations available in Europe and America for the apparent superiority of Germanic peoples, the Mormon synthesis provided a plausible explanation for missionary success, as well as a reassuring defense of Mormon ethnic claims against a hostile world. It is this defensive function, furthermore, that helps to account for the persistence of this Mormon racialist ideology well into the 20th century. For by the turn of that century, conversions in Europe had largely dried up, and the church was starting to look elsewhere for the descendants of Ephraim and Israel. After that, the search for Ephraim was extended to various other parts of the world, mainly insofar as remnants of that lineage evidenced some receptivity to the LDS missionary message. The effect was to universalize the presumptive potential for spiritual receptivity to various parts of the world, rather than assuming such receptivity was an inherited trait mainly of the Nordic or Germanic countries. Meanwhile, during the past half century, now during most recent decades, redefinitions of lineage destiny have been taking place also with regard to other ethnic groups, particularly the Lamanites or American Indians, black Africans and African Americans, and even Jews. So I will now turn to a brief overview of changing conceptions about each of those groups. First of all, American Indians as Israelites. Joseph Smith was not the only religious thinker of his time with a theory about the Israelite origins of the American Aborigines, but he was the only one to claim possession of their Israelite history. I will not take the time here to recount the general plot of the Book of Mormon story, for it is well known in this audience that the book identifies these Aborigines or American Indians as Lamanites. Although these Lamanites are portrayed as a fallen and degraded people, having rejected their ancient American prophets of God, they are nevertheless literal descendants of Manasseh and Ephraim, sons of the ancient biblical Joseph. As such, they are peoples of divine destiny, waiting to be gathered by the Lord's modern emissaries in these last days. Indeed, the Book of Mormon and the earliest Mormon discourse portrayed the white or Anglo-Mormons as Gentiles, commissioned by God to bring the Book of Mormon and the Gospel of Christ to the Lamanites. After that, the converted Lamanites would assume their divine commission to build a city and temple of Zion, America, as the gathering place for the 10 tribes. In this endeavor, according to the earliest understanding, the white Mormon Gentiles would have an auxiliary and supportive role. But later, as I have indicated, the Mormons came to understand themselves as literal Israelites and began to take the main responsibility for building Zion, with but little objection, one might add, from the largely unconverted Lamanites. The earliest recorded missionary foray of the church was sent to Indian tribes in the Mississippi region, and the Mormons never forsook their divine commission to convert the Lamanites. Nevertheless, the 19th century ended with but little to show for decades of missionary effort among the Indians, at least if we're talking about enduring converts. At several different junctures in early Utah history, the church leaders declared new resolutions and sent new missionary expeditions to the various Indian peoples of the Mountain West and Southwest. Yet few proselytes endured. Much of the explanation for the limited success lies with the opposition experienced by the church from U.S. government Indian agents and from missionary enterprises of other denominations. Yet it must be conceded that with rare and brief exceptions, it was the Indians themselves who showed but little interest in becoming either Lamanites or Mormons. After about 1870, most of the Indian peoples were confined by the government to reservations, and Mormons, like other Americans, saw less and less of them. Then, with the assimilation of Mormons into the American mainstream after the turn of the century, succeeding generations of Mormons acquired essentially the same distorted and condescending view of the Aboriginal peoples as other Americans did. It was as though the Lamanites had returned to the pages of the Book of Mormon, and only the degraded and savage Indians remained in the Mormon consciousness. Even the traditional Indian country of the Mountain States and Plain States, even in that traditional Indian country, Mormon missionaries began to be sent mainly to white communities, and no more Lamanite missions were initiated until 1943. If the North American Indians had proved reluctant to see themselves as Lamanites, Mormons had long realized that there were other potential Lamanites farther south. As missionary work bogged down among the tribes in the U.S., the church began making forays into Mexico, and the first enduring mission was established there in 1901. It took another 25 years to establish missions beyond Mexico in South America, and even then, the missionaries began working primarily with German and Italian immigrants of Brazil and Argentina. Yet increasingly throughout the present century, the growth of the church has been strong and consistent throughout Latin America, especially since World War II. And now more than a third of all Mormons are to be found in that part of the world. As that growth began to occur, church discourse began to refer less and less often to the Lamanite identity of the North American Indian tribes, or indeed to refer to American Indians at all. Instead, the Lamanite identity was increasingly emphasized and broadened in reference to other peoples in the world where missionary success was more apparent, namely in Mexico, Latin America, and Polynesia. With scattered and periodic exceptions, one sees a long gap in the relationship between the LDS Church and the North American Indians until the middle of the 20th century. Then, beginning in the 1940s and 50s, a renewal of formal church programs for the Indians began, which was to last for about three decades. This renewal, however, does not seem to have been the outcome of deliberate organizational policy review and change, so much as the response of the leadership of the church to initiatives of a few local individual Mormons. What followed was a particularly interesting, next few decades, was a particularly interesting and felicitous congruence of organizational and biographical developments. Particularly important was the career of Spencer W. Kimball, a devout and conscientious local leader in Arizona, long a sympathetic and humanitarian promoter of Indian causes in his region. Elder Kimball became an apostle in 1943 and president of the church 30 years later. Very early in his apostleship, he was placed in charge of a new church agency called the Lamanite Committee, alternatively called the Indian Committee. From then on, the growth and fate of the LDS posture toward the American Indians was tied intimately to his career. While Elder Kimball was a key individual in a powerful position, he was by no means the only individual responsible for the renewal of church commitment to the Indians. One of the most noteworthy programs starting at mid-century arose through the initiative of a local Arizona family, which heeded the pleadings of a Navajo girl for their help and sponsorship in seeking a modern education. The eventual result was a massive program called Placement, in which Indian children, some as young as eight, with the permission of their parents, sometimes reluctant, were placed with white LDS foster families during each school year. At its height, in about 1970, this program was placing 5,000 Indian children a year, many of whom returned each fall to the same family until their graduation from high school. The white foster families, of course, were personally and financially responsible for all aspects of the lives of these Indian children. As one might imagine, this project in cross-cultural relationships produced situations ranging from the sublime to the comical to the tragic. There were also other major programs for the Indians in which the church invested enormous resources during this same general period, talking about the 50s and 60s, such as the Indian Seminary Program. Probably the most conspicuous and expensive programs for Indians, however, were based at Brigham Young University. These were basically of two kinds. One, a program of full scholarships for several hundred Indian students each year, combined with a variety of academic, social, and cultural support services to help the students adapt to the norms and expectations of the university while still retaining pride and identity in their own respective cultures. Second kind of BYU program was more in the nature of off-campus extension programs, something like the international AID programs of the U.S. Peace Corps, in which experts were sent under university auspices to Indian reservations in order to provide technical guidance and training in agriculture, range management, construction, even social services for families or individuals troubled with alcohol abuse, conflict, or neglected children. During the heyday of these programs in the 1960s and 70s, they fit well with the social and political environment then obtaining, not only in the church where Elder Kimball's career was reaching its apex, but also in the American nation, which was undergoing a powerful civil rights movement, lifting various disadvantaged minorities out of their social and economic deprivation. What the LDS church undertook in its own regional backyard for the Indian peoples might be understood as a particularly Mormon parallel to the various programs and initiatives undertaken during that same period for black Americans by other denominations in the major U.S. urban areas. There were parallels also in the various ways in which the intended beneficiary peoples responded to the proffered programs. Some Indians, like some blacks, held assimilationist aspirations, welcoming and appreciating the assistance and support of both church and government, as indeed overdue. They were often objects of scorn, however, from the more militant and separatist movements within their own populations, who saw both the churches and the government bureaucrats as undermining their cultural heritage and co-opting their political momentum. For this reason, and others which I shall mention shortly, the mid-century renewal of a special LDS focus on American Indians did not survive the demise of President Kimball in 1985. So then we come to what might be called the New Lamanites. By that time, that is mid-1985, the special LDS missions for North American Indians were already being reorganized and assimilated once again into the regular missions of the church in the various states and provinces. The same was true of the special seminaries for religious instruction of Indian youth. The placement program for reservation school children with white families during each school year was abolished for all practical purposes. Perhaps most conspicuously, the special programs at BYU for Indian scholarships, Indian instructional support, and other forms of special focus on the needs of the Lamanites were closed down or transferred to private agencies. While a variety of reasons for this decline in Lamanite emphasis might be offered, it seems clear that the main explanation is to be found once again in a pragmatic cost-benefit analysis of such a use of church resources. While not obvious at the time, the death knell of these special programs for Indians was probably sounded by Apostle Boyd K. Packer during a 1979 speech to an assembly of BYU Indian students during Indian Week in February 1979. While couched in diplomatic language, Elder Packer's remarks were unmistakable in their purport. In effect, he made a number of invidious comparisons between the Lamanites of North America and those of South America, chastising the North American Indians in the assembly before him for a general failure to live up to the hopes and expectations the church had placed in them during an entire generation of special programs. He charged, in effect, that they had not used their special educational advantages to serve the church as missionaries and leaders among other Lamanites, and had not indeed even remained very faithful to the LDS way of life. Some of what he criticized them for, including, say, for example, a reluctance to take on organizational leadership and conduct meetings and the like, could be understood as tribal cultural traits, indicating simply an incomplete assimilation to white ways. In any case, as Elder Packer said in one place, quote, "If it sounds like I'm scolding you, it will be because I am," unquote. Probably more than anyone realized, Elder Packer's remarks on that occasion also signaled a redefinition of Lamanite lineage, operationally, if not ideologically, such that the main stronghold of that lineage was now to be found in Latin America and in Polynesia, not on the reservations of the U.S. or Canada. There is no question that Joseph Smith and the entire founding generation of Mormons believed that the Indians of North America were the Lamanites of the Book of Mormon. They certainly recognized that other Aboriginal peoples of the hemisphere might also be Lamanites, and they saw evidence from a brief passage in the Book of Mormon that at least some Polynesians might be included. Yet 19th century Mormons searched almost exclusively in North America for the Lamanites who in prophecy were to join with them in building a new Zion in America. Despite very hard going for more than a century, the LDS Church periodically launched one special initiative or program after another to fulfill its God-given responsibility to these benighted peoples of destiny, quote-unquote. In terms of the sheer number of conversions on record, these efforts did yield more than negligible results. By 1980, there were more than 60,000 American Indians on church membership records, constituting 5% of the total North American Indian population, which is more than twice the percentage, incidentally, for white Americans. Yet among these thousands of Indians, relatively few have married within the faith and established Mormon families, or embraced normative Mormonism in the conduct of their lives. Accordingly, relatively few can be brought into organizational leadership, where they can be bishops or stake presidents, and thus promote the growth of the church from within their own cultures. The contrast of Mormon converts in Latin America is dramatic. A third of the entire population of the church now lives in that part of the hemisphere. The local and regional leadership and much of the missionary work is in the hands of native members, including many of Aboriginal or mixed ancestry. The same has been true in most of Polynesia, where in some cases the LDS percentage of the population approaches half of the people in some Polynesian countries. Accordingly, some in the church have begun to, in recent years, to wonder if it is in these countries that the real Lamanites are to be found. This is not an issue, however, that is ever addressed in any formal way by the church leadership itself, whose concerns are far more pragmatic, namely conversion and retention of members, in whatever manner their lineage might be constructed in spiritual or theological terms. Precisely locating the true Israelites, or Lamanites, of the Americas, has always been of far more interest to Mormon academics and intellectual apologists than to the ecclesiastical leaders. It was at the turn of the present century that the first expedition was led by the president of BYU to search for the ancient cities of the Book of Mormon in Mexico. The expedition was an expensive and embarrassing debacle, and no similar enterprise was undertaken for half a century. Then in the 1950s, a group of Mormon archaeologists, some amateurs and some professionals, also based at BYU, formed the New World Archaeological Foundation, backed in large part by church funds, and began again to search in Latin America for archaeological evidence that might authenticate the Book of Mormon scientifically. This effort, which lasted a decade or so, was more sophisticated than the earlier one, but scarcely more successful. It was unlikely in any case that the scientific world outside of Mormonism would place much credence in the logical discoveries of Mormon apologists, however careful and successful their work might have seemed to insiders. The most recent academic approach under church auspices to the study of the Book of Mormon and its ostensible Israelite protagonists can be found in the Foundation for Ancient Research in Mormon Studies, acronym FARMS, organized 2 decades ago as a private foundation but recently brought under BYU administration. FARMS sponsors and promotes all kinds of research on ancient scriptures and documents, including, for example, the Dead Sea Scrolls, but its main focus is on the Book of Mormon as an authentic ancient book of scripture. Its approach is much more cautious and realistic than the earlier efforts. For one thing, while FARMS reprints, with permissions, relative archaeological literature on pre-Columbian migrations to America as published by non-Mormon experts, it does not do any archaeological research of its own. Rather, its research on the Book of Mormon is primarily of a literary and philological kind, which is far less subject to debunking than the earlier archaeological research. For purposes of the main argument I am making here, the most important feature of the FARMS publications is their apparent consensus around the Sorensen thesis. This is John Sorensen's book, Ancient America as a Setting for the Book of Mormon. It's been out maybe 20 years now. And I say the most important feature for my purposes here of FARMS publications is the apparent consensus of these publications around the Sorensen thesis that the Book of Mormon story all took place within a radius of about 500 miles in the Yucatan area of Mexico and Guatemala. Therefore, if there are any survivors of that ancient Israelite or Lamanite people, they are probably located in that area and not on the Indian reservations of North America. The success of Mormon missionary work in that area during the past generation has lent credence to such a supposition. It is important to emphasize again that there has been no new determination or pronouncement from the church leadership as to where today's Lamanites might or might not be located. Yet it seems reasonable to see FARMS with its BYU auspices as the source of a new quasi-official definition of Lamanite lineage, which might explain simultaneously both the rapid growth of Mormonism in Mesoamerica and the relative stagnation of such growth in North America. It is unlikely that the church leadership will ever make any official statements on this matter, for one of the interesting side stories in this process concerns the tendency of various native converts to become themselves invested in the definition of themselves as true Israelites. This tendency contributed to the recent falling out between the church leadership and Elder George P. Lee, the only Native American ever to serve in the ranks of the general authorities before his excommunication a decade ago. The same Native tendency that is appropriating or constructing one's own lineage as Israelite or Lamanite, that same tendency contributed to the major schism among Mexican Mormons in the 1930s, Third Convention movement. More recently, Thomas W. Murphy has discovered this same construction of Israelite identity among Mormons in Guatemala, and Grant Underwood, among others, has found it in elaborate form among the Maoris of New Zealand. So it's fascinating to see the different uses that different peoples make in negotiate of a certain lineage construction as they create it and negotiate that lineage and integrate it with their own religious framework. And so, you know, what I'm showing or trying to show is that that kind of comes and goes with different peoples depending on certain historical circumstances. The white Anglo-Mormons of 19th century Utah were big in this. Not such a big thing among us anymore, but now that we might have this tendency to take a more place less emphasis upon Israelite lineage and a more universalistic view about how you become a child of Abraham, like Paul the Apostle did, now that we may be inclined as whites to do that, some of the other peoples that we've been working with may not be so readily inclined to give up this identification of their own lineage. That's a fascinating predicament. So that's my wrap on the American Indian situation and the shifting conceptions of lineage identity, both among them and among the whites who look upon them. Now, Africans, African Americans, and the cursed lineage. The traditional LDS outlook on people of black African lineage is much more widely recognized and remarked upon, and other scholars, as well as myself, have written extensively on the subject. Accordingly, I will give it rather short shrift here. It is generally conceded by scholars familiar with the subject that the prohibition against bestowing the lay priesthood on blacks did not originate with the founding prophet Joseph Smith. A probable trend toward this prohibition can be discerned during the first few years after Smith's assassination, but the policy itself did not become official and public until it was announced by Brigham Young in Utah in 1852. According to the detailed historical accounts of Lester Bush and Newell Bringhurst, a tendency to deny the priesthood to people of black ancestry finally hardened into an actual church policy only after 1880, when Joseph Smith's books of Moses and Abraham had been canonized and thus became available for scriptural support of the policy, particularly with the inference of lineage assignment in premortal life, which was an idea, again, that comes out of the Utah period, not earlier. This was also the period in which began the fullest and most rapid embrace of British Israelism and Anglo-Saxon triumphalism in the construction of LDS lineage, as I've explained elsewhere. Racialist explanations for differential human conditions, increasingly common in both Europe and America, and I'm not talking about Mormons in Europe and America, I'm talking about the intellectual milieu among scientists and intellectuals of Europe and America. We tend to forget how powerful were doctrines of this kind, especially the inexorability of the movement westward of superior Anglo-Saxon peoples who, you know, manifest destiny in America, British imperialism elsewhere, and in general conference sermons you see during the late 19th century, you not only see these ideas cited, but you see their authors cited, non-Mormon authors cited in general conference sermons, to the effect that these are the Ephraimites we're talking about, these powerful Anglo-Saxons. So this must have made this seem all the more plausible in Utah. That is, the prohibition against blacks must have seemed all the more plausible in Utah with its almost total Northern European homogeneity until at least the First World War. Even as late as the 1960s, my surveys of Mormons in Salt Lake City and San Francisco revealed a widespread popular acceptance of the traditional folklore about biblical marks and curses on the descendants of Cain or Ham, and of premortal failings by those spirits assigned to African lineage. If the United States itself, including all its institutions of government, maintained discriminatory policies toward its black citizens until after the Second World War, it is not really surprising that the priesthood policy of the Utah-based church, relatively isolated from the racial ferment of the rest of the country, did not change for another whole generation. The policy change toward Africans and African Americans in 1978 is at least as interesting a story as how the original policy got started in the first place. I have recounted this story of this change in some detail elsewhere, and others have also offered parts of the explanation. Lester Bush has something about that, too, in the latest issue of the Journal of Mormon History, his interactions with general authorities over this back in the 60s. Outside observers have tended to seek the explanation for the church's change toward blacks in external political pressure or in church sensitivity to public image. Of course, such influences cannot be discounted, but they should not be exaggerated. For here again, the explanation for change is best understood in light of the Church's own internal imperatives, particularly its growth-oriented pragmatism. Two episodes in particular were influential in driving home to LDS leaders the potential of their traditional ideas about race and lineage to undermine their aspirations for a worldwide Mormon presence. The first of these episodes occurred in the early 1960s. A very promising opportunity for Mormon expansion into West Africa had to be aborted when the Nigerian government refused entry to Mormon missionaries because of the church's traditional policies and teachings about people of black African ancestry. The church leadership came close to a consensus on policy change in the wake of that very episode. It was the second episode, however, that finally precipitated the change in policy. This was a decision, again largely on the initiative of President Kimball, to build a Mormon temple in Brazil, a country with an especially large contingent of African ancestry. Despite the discriminatory policy toward people of that ancestry, the growth of the church in Brazil had been so rapid by 1974 that a temple was overdue by the usual church criteria. The problem, of course, was that priesthood access is a condition for participation in Mormon temple rituals. Thus, on the one hand, Brazil was clearly ready for a temple. On the other hand, however, the church faced the prospect of having to deny temple entry to a large proportion of its Brazilian converts, many of whom, indeed, would have contributed their time, energy, and treasure to its construction. Just weeks before the temple was completed in 1978, President Kimball, in an astute and inspiring combination of spiritual and political leadership, brought his colleagues in the hierarchy to an acceptance of his own understanding of God's will in the matter. The important contribution of the missionary effort in Brazil and of the converts there in bringing about this policy change is the subject, incidentally, of a recent paper by Mark Grover that was presented at the last May conference of the Mormon History Association. A lot was going on among the Brazilian saints themselves that we don't hear about in North America that greatly influenced the decision of the brethren, I think, finally to make that change. Although the policy of priesthood restriction was changed 21 years ago, there remains a strong residue, at least among Mormons in the U.S., of the theological folklore traditionally used to justify that policy, and which I found especially strong in my surveys of the late 60s. This racist folklore continues to appear in the latest editions of widely purchased books written by earlier Mormon leaders, and in the grassroots explanations, quote-unquote, sometimes offered by lifelong Mormons when they are asked about the erstwhile church policy toward blacks. As long as that folklore lingers in the popular Mormon grapevine, it will continue to offend converts and potential converts of African ancestry. While the current president of the church has publicly indicated that he sees no necessity for formally repudiating doctrines that are obviously obsolete, some of his younger colleagues in the leadership share the view that whether or not it is obsolete, racist folklore from the past can continue to undermine the prospects for church growth until it is formally and publicly repudiated. Talking about pre-existent sins, Cain's, Ham's, Mark's, and curses and all that stuff. Such folklore, of course, has always been primarily trained Mormon growth among black populations in Africa, in the Caribbean, or in Latin America. However, Mormon growth among black Americans has been very slow, and retention has been relatively poor, a predicament likely attributable, at least in part, to the persistence of racist folklore at the Mormon grassroots in the United States. So that's my take on the changing conceptions of lineage where the blacks are concerned. Now to take the third and last ethnic category about which Mormons have had differing conceptions about lineage, we'll go to the Jews. Both before Joseph Smith's time and since, the gathering and return of the scattered Jews to Palestine has been considered an important preliminary and harbinger to the second coming of Jesus Christ, at least in Protestant Christianity. In Mormonism, as in other 19th century denominations, there was some difference of opinion, and thus ambiguity, as to whether or not the return of the Jews would entail their conversion to Christianity, and if so, whether that conversion would come before, during, or after their return to Jerusalem. These questions were not resolved within Mormon teaching or discourse during Joseph Smith's time, although one sees in Mormon discourse from the beginning a strong philo-Semitic strain and a general rejection of anti-Semitism. As Stephen Epperson and Arnold Green have explained, Green's essay again is in the latest issue of the Journal of Mormon History. Getting some good plugs in that, aren't we? As Stephen Epperson, you may know his book, Mormons and Jews. I think that's the title, and then there's a subtitle. As Stephen Epperson and Arnold Green have explained, the successors of Joseph Smith in the LDS leadership tended to divide into two camps on the Jewish question. One camp, following Brigham Young's ideas, expected the conversion of the Jews to be delayed until after their gathering in Palestine, and even then, somewhat grudging. However, the other camp, following Parley and Orson Pratt, embraced a more optimistic and universalistic position, holding with the Apostle Paul that since Christ's time, the ancient covenant with Abraham was fulfilled in the Christian gospel, to which the truly devout Jews would now turn, along with all of humankind. Since Young was the president of the church until his death in 1877, his views tended to obtain in church proselyting policy. Accordingly, although a handful of Jews as individuals joined the church during the 19th century, no missions to the Jews collectively were dispatched until the 20th century, and then only spasmodically. Let's remember that Orson Hyde's dedication of the land of Palestine was a dedication not for preaching the gospel, but for a return of the Jews. Epperson argues furthermore, not without criticism, that some of the early Mormon leaders seem to have hypothesized that the Jews had, as it were, a side deal with God, obviating the need for their formal conversion to Christianity before the end times. After World War I, the pogroms of Eastern Europe and the Balfour Declaration, the prophesied return of the Jews to Palestine en masse seemed to Mormons and other Christians once again to be imminent. Along with others, Mormons deplored the traditional treatment of the Jews, even while seeing their displacement as a fulfillment of prophecy. As early as 1920, the president of the church issued warnings in general conference against anti-Semitism, and hopes ran high that the latest Jewish gathering would be accompanied by a new receptivity to the Christian, particularly LDS, gospel. When church authority B.H. Roberts was appointed mission president over the eastern United States in 1922, he recognized early on that millions of Jews lived in New York and elsewhere under his jurisdiction. He gave special attention to his Jewish prospects and established collaborative relationships with a Jewish Christian group. He also wrote a book and a number of proselyting tracts, packaging the Mormon message especially for Jews. This effort persisted until 1932, 10 years, without producing a single Jewish convert. A similar renewal of enthusiasm for potential Jewish conversions occurred after the formation of the State of Israel in 1948. This time, the main champion of Jewish conversion was Apostle LeGrand Richards, who was given permission in the early 1950s to establish a number of, you might call, experimental Jewish missions in several U.S. cities, including especially Los Angeles. His book, Israel, Do You Know?, was a clarion call for Judah to join with Mormon Ephraim in preparing for the return of the Messiah. And a number of special proselyting plans for Jews were designed by LDS mission leaders in various cities. Once again, the effort lasted about a decade with a very poor cost-benefit ratio. And by 1960, the first presidency abolished the special missions and directed that henceforth Jews were not to be given any special attention in proselyting. Since then, with the rare exception of half-hearted effort in the mid-70s or of a local mission president here and there, the LDS Church has deliberately refrained from proselyting among the Jews as a people. Yet popular LDS conceptions about Jews, as I found in my surveys 30-some years ago, have always been remarkably free of anti-Semitism, despite a belief that Jews will eventually have to be converted. If we look at recent Mormon relationships with Jews, they have taken the form not of proselyting, but of searching for common ground and common interests. Mormons have always favored Zionism in Palestine. Of course, Mormons have always favored Zionism in Palestine, though in recent years with a more balanced appreciation for Palestinian rights and aspirations. Yet in their relationships with Israelis and with Jews throughout the world, Mormons have learned that prospects for the conversion of the Jews in any appreciable numbers are extremely remote for the foreseeable future. Of course, theologically and theoretically, no doubt Mormon leaders would say that sooner or later, every knee must bow and every tongue confess that Jesus is the Christ, and that includes the Jews. However, it is doubtful that any Mormon leader today would expect to live to see such a spiritual consummation of the world's history. Any singling out of the lineage of Judah for any special proselyting attention. Meanwhile, perhaps in preparation for the final days, it is important for Mormons and Jews to build amicable relationships of the kind that, for example, have made possible the establishment of the BYU Center in Jerusalem, on condition, incidentally, of no Mormon proselyting. And also the collaboration between BYU and Israeli academics in preserving and promoting a study of the Dead Sea Scrolls. However, perhaps no incident so well typifies the new Mormon sensitivity to the Jewish religious heritage as the rapid response of LDS leaders in 1995 to Jewish complaints about the vicarious temple baptisms of deceased Holocaust victims. Thin pages here, and I sometimes skip them. You might just prefer that I did, actually. So there was that 1995 incident. In a gesture rich with both symbolic and political significance, the church forthwith canceled all these vicarious Jewish baptisms, even though they presumably would not have had any spiritual or theological significance to non-believers. In light of this incident, one might be tempted to conclude that the Mormons have given up, at least temporarily, on efforts to convert even those Jews who have departed to the next world. Now, a few concluding paragraphs. A section I entitle, The Ascendancy of Mormon Universalism and Erosion of Ethnic Consciousness. The final decades of the 20th century have brought a virtual end to the LDS focus on lineage and ethnicity in interpreting the spiritual histories and destinies of the various peoples of the earth. This focus has been displaced increasingly by the Pauline universalism also present in Mormonism from the beginning, and of course in New Testament Christianity all along. In symbolic terms, one might say that the blood of Christ has finally replaced the blood of Israel as the more important theological idea for Mormons, among others. This trend has, of course, paralleled the effort to eliminate racial discrimination in the United States, the home base of Mormonism. Yet it would be a gross oversimplification to see this trend as merely a Mormon effort to achieve political correctness on the American political scene. At least as important has been the practical experience and differential success of the church in its own missionizing programs. I have argued that across time, Mormons have attached changing differential spiritual significance to the African, Jewish, and Amerindian lineages, depending largely on the missionary imperative and its prospects. With respect also to the traditional construction of the lineage of Anglo-Saxon and Northern European Mormons as Israelite, especially Ephraimite, we can also see a definite tendency during the 20th century in the discourse of church leaders to drop the earlier glorification of their own European lineage in favor of a universal appeal to the world's peoples. This process seems to have proceeded in stages. The first stage was the decline in church growth and missionary prospects in Northern Europe, which had been regarded as the homeland of the superior Germanic and Israelite breeds led there by providence or destiny. Part of this decline in missionary prospects in northwestern Europe was attributable, of course, to the large-scale migration of Mormon converts from that part of the world to Utah. Yet after about 1870 or so, conversion rates in the northern European countries no longer replaced the departing converts, and some of the church leaders remarked publicly that perhaps the harvest of Israelite descendants had already been completed there, with little but gleaning left to do. I think today's missionaries to Europe would probably agree. Meanwhile, as the second stage in the process of universalization, the blood of Israel began to be discovered in various other parts of the world. I have already commented on the successes in Polynesia during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Besides there and in Latin America, missions were opened in Eastern Europe, White South Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. To all these regions, church leaders and mission presidents made visits and tours, returning to Utah to proclaim that the blood of Israel was to be found in all such climes. Even after the Japan mission was closed in 1924 for lack of results, the mission president returned to testify in general conference that the blood of Israel was present in that country from ancient migrations that had come there out of the Middle East. In effect, these traveling church leaders became advocates, as it were, for the presence of Israelite lineages in the various countries that they visited. One might see as a third stage in this process the gradual evolution in the understanding of lineage assignment during patriarchal blessings. A regular feature of these blessings since the 1840s, at least, has been the declaration of lineage, in which the patriarch designates the individual's genealogical descent, usually from one of the ancient tribes of Israel, and almost always from the tribe of Ephraim. Until recent decades, this lineage assignment, as it is now more often called, was typically understood in literal terms. I say until recent decades, it was typically understood in literal terms. That is, the patriarch, by divine insight, was revealing the individual's actual genealogy. Today, however, different patriarchs have different understandings of lineage assignment. By no means always literal. The 1992 Encyclopedia of Mormonism, indeed, explains that it does not matter whether or not the lineage mentioned is literal, for it is essentially, quote, the line and legacy through which one's blessings are transmitted, unquote. Obviously, such recent ambiguity in the significance of this lineage declaration, whether or not intended, has had the effect of de-emphasizing the importance of literal lineage, and thereby supporting the more general trend toward universalizing access to the Abrahamic covenant, irrespective of literal lineage. With 60,000 Mormon missionaries now in most countries of the world, references to lineage as either favored or cursed by God have disappeared from the discourse of church leaders. Whether in general conference or in church literature, the opposite message is now declared from Mormon pulpits, as it was by Paul of old. The emphasis is now upon the common blood and common origin of all people as children of the same God. The late President Howard Hunter declared, for example, quote, race makes no difference, color makes no difference, nationality makes no difference. We are all of one blood and the literal spirit offspring of our Heavenly Father. And went on to say the gospel stands, quote, squarely against all stifling traditions based on race, language, and cultural background, unquote. More recently, James E. Faust of the First Presidency observed that in his experience, quote, no race or class seems superior to any other in spirituality or faithfulness, unquote. In conclusion, an important line of argument in this paper has been that traditional Mormon teachings about lineage as destiny have proved operationally flexible in light of church experience with conversion and retention in various parts of the world. In the case of African lineage, the divine curse was removed as missionary prospects increased in Africa and Latin America. In the case of the Jews, who have proved consistently impervious across time to Mormon and other Christian conversion efforts, the church has retained its belief in the divine destiny of the lineage of Judah, but has left their conversion to God's own timetable and special arrangements, sensing the wisdom, meanwhile, of maintaining good relationships between Judah and Ephraim. As for the Aborigines of the Western Hemisphere and their Israelite lineage, we can see a gradual shift in the operational, not ideologically, operational definition of that lineage from north to south, as church growth has bogged down among the Indians of North America and, by contrast, has mushroomed in Latin America. Religious communities, like societies more generally, sometimes rise above the historical realities of a given time and place to promulgate ideals that are sublime in conception but can be operationally fulfilled only gradually. So it has been, for example, with the Anglo-American heritage of political liberty and human rights, which, we trust and hope, is closer to a description of real life today than it was at the time of either the English or the American revolutions. Similarly, the Christian heritage, having begun on the philosophical premise of universal brotherhood, was somehow translated across European history into theological justifications for various forms of bigotry and barbarism, but now struggles in most places to return to its roots in the life and mission of the humble and loving Jesus of Nazareth. In a much shorter time frame, Mormonism, too, experienced a century or more of racialist attitudes and policies, partly as a participant in the general culture of its homeland, but it has in recent years been returning to its roots in the Christian gospel of Jesus and Paul. In some ways, it is an inspiring irony that Mormons, like many others, have been brought to embrace this universalism directly as a concomitant of their own proselyting program. That is, as they have gone forth to convert peoples in increasingly exotic locales to the particularistic LDS gospel, they have come to recognize the general capacity in all peoples to respond to spiritual influences and to missionary service that is sensitively rendered. As continues in this mode, the church is poised to become a world religion in the 21st century. Thank you. Don't know how much time.
Oh, we have a little bit of time. It is supposed to end at about 12:45.
Oh,
so
gosh,
we have time for questions from the audience. I notice that there are several people here that obviously are just itching to show that they are true Ephraimites and would like to talk a little bit. So, yes, please. Yes, if you'd like.
Or I'll repeat your question.
We'll repeat your question.
Well, again, operationally, I think it does not. What we have, I think, there is a kind of an interesting survival in the way that paleontologists use the term, or anthropologists. I think an interesting survival of a theological idea that has lost its operational significance. Now, once that had a lot of operational significance, it defined who were the chosen people, who were the lineage, and therefore who had the responsibility for carrying out the divine will among the peoples of the earth, who was to hold the priesthood, and all of that. That's all gone, and we have this kind of interesting ideological survival. I have, in the article that was cited, I have an interesting couple of quotations from Eldridge G. Smith toward the end of his career before he was made emeritus, in which he explicitly denies that this is a literal pronouncement of lineage and says that he wished the saints would quit thinking about the lineage assignment because it distracts them from the main part of the blessing, which is the promises and the potentials and the contributions they can make. I have to tell the tape that this is an answer to a question about what significance does lineage assignment and patriarchal blessings have anymore. And as I just said, I don't see that it has any. What the future is of that, I don't know. It will continue, I think, to have some symbolic significance. I think it's going to mean different things to different people, not only different things to different patriarchs, but it's going to mean different things to different saints who get their blessings. And there may be, well be some saints who will continue to think, gee, that's great. This is my genealogy. All I got to do is find how I'm connected to Ephraim, and I can get the rest of my genealogy out of the Old Testament. So I think it's going to mean different things to different people, but I think operationally it means nothing anymore.
If I had a son or whatever that was told he was from Benjamin, I would boost him up by telling him that Saul was the first king of Israel, was chosen from this small, wonderful tribe of Benjamin, and the great apostle Paul was also a Benjamite. So, you know, I think the question has been answered pretty good. Another one.
Well, the question is, the questioner observes that in, growing up in the church, he had the understanding that the declaration of lineage was the most important part of the blessing. And so what does that mean for the future of patriarchal blessings? In part, I think I answered that when I responded to the earlier question, but the significance attached to the declaration of lineage was always something that was a product of what you might call folk Mormon, as opposed to any kind of doctrinal statement that came out in General Conference. I don't think my fairly extensive review of historic official literature on this, I don't think I ever came across a statement to the effect that the most important part of the blessing was lineage. But I think that our grandparents probably gave us that idea, and other people who talked to us about it. What I think is probably going to result is what Elder G. Smith would like to have result, I gather, from his comments to which I just referred, namely that we will come to pay less attention to lineage assignment and look at the rest of the blessing, which I think in today's church is something that the church leaders would prefer. Well, to the lineage matter, I say you're exactly right. Why pay any attention to it? The lineage has no operational significance, and if we're going to go back to the early Christian idea that was always there in the writings of Paul, namely that when you accept Christ, you are one of Abraham's children. There's no more any difference between you and literal descendants of Abraham. If that's going to be our belief, then yeah, I can't see there's any significance to lineage. But I think, again, it's the uses of that idea that are intriguing and have a potential for either good or evil. If you make the kind of use of it that Lee was just talking about, you know, tell your son, the Benjaminite, that this means that he has great potential and that he should act on that in the spirit and tradition of this great king, why, that might be a constructive use of it. If, however, people who get lineage assignment take away from that the idea that there's something special and everybody who has some other lineage is not as good, why, then that's not a constructive use of it. Yes?
Then the guy next door who is not getting it.
Yeah, that's probably true. I hesitate to comment on Utah because I don't live in Utah, and only briefly in my life have I ever. So I don't want to say anything that denigrates the Utah culture because some of my best friends live here. And relatives, I must say, nearly all of them. Yes?
I've heard some anecdotal stories, and pure nonsense, or it doesn't have some foundation in fact?
Question has to do with a rumor or folktale or something?
Folktale
that the questioner picked up earlier in life, I gather, to the effect that the presiding brethren once had a discussion about the future constituency of the church in which J. Reuben Clark and Reed Smoot seemed to take the position that the church was forever destined to be made up primarily of people of Northern European ancestry, but David O. McKay argued that the church should define itself in more universal terms. I don't have any knowledge about any such particular kind of deliberation, but I do recall finding in General Conference sermons comments by those three brethren that would be in accord with that understanding of their views. But I don't know about a particular deliberation to that effect. Yes? Question is, some years back in France, the questioner knew an LDS couple that wanted to be married in the temple, and the future wife in question already had a black child, so they would not seal the black child. That's consistent with what I understand church policy used to be. Questioner asks about another folktale that you heard through your husband, was it? Who was in South Africa on a mission where he heard a story of a case. A brother there, presumably a white brother, was to be ordained to the priesthood. This is while the policy against ordaining blacks was still in effect. The white brother in question was to be ordained to the priesthood. The person doing the ordaining, as he laid his hands on his head and began to proceed with that ordination, received a kind of sudden revelation that this ostensibly white brother did in fact have a small part of black African ancestry. So the ordination was aborted. I think that is a folk tale because I have heard that same tale come out of a half a dozen different countries. It's possible that it happened, but I think it would make a wonderful addition to Bert Wilson's collection of Mormon folk tales, if it isn't already in there. Yes. Well, it's a long story, and I'm really reluctant to take a lot of audience time with it because it's all in print. Sure. I would refer you to particularly to two articles in Dialogue, both by Lester Bush. One was published in 1969 and was a review of a small book by Taggart. And the second and much longer Lester Bush article was in a 1973 issue of Dialogue, occupying nearly half or more of the entire content of that issue, recounting a blow-by-blow, giving a blow-by-blow account of the history of how this developed. Also, Newell Bringhurst has a book on the subject called Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, published about early 80s, I think. I can't remember exactly when. And that's another account. I think out of all of that literature, what you would learn is that there is no evidence that the Prophet Joseph had this policy. There is almost irrefutable evidence that on at least two occasions he was present at the ordination of black people, the beginning of the black policy occurs in Utah, or on the way to Utah. Bush and Bringhurst have different theories about why they think that occurred. It's hard to know why exactly, other than good old American racism. But you can understand some possibilities, you know. White Southerners converting to the church, bringing their black slaves to Utah. You want your slave to be your bishop? It was complicated by things like that. Utah In 1852, the Utah Territorial Legislature passed enabling legislation permitting slavery in Utah of both blacks and Indians. And there's the reason for the enslavement of Indians, another whole different story. The reason for permitting slavery of blacks was simply to accommodate Southern converts that were coming west. It's important to remember that the Book of Abraham and the Book of Moses, while they were kind of around, were not standard works of the church until 1880. And only after 1880 do you begin to find in church discourse a resort to either the pre-existence explanation or the Pharaoh's lineage explanation for denying the priesthood. And so there is no recorded revelation to any church president in which he claims the Lord instructed him to establish that policy. The closest you got is the 1852 statement by Brigham Young, made to the legislature, by the way, kind of surprisingly, not in General Conference, in which Brigham Young says, if no other prophet said it before, I say it now, that they're not entitled to have the priesthood. That's the closest thing we've got to a revelation. It's probably more than you wanted to know, but that's it. Yes. Maybe. I'm neglecting to repeat the question, unfortunately. I apologize. The earlier question that I answered at some length dealt with how the policy against blacks got started in the first place and whether Joseph Smith was the source of that. So I answered that. Now this question is whether it might be fair to see B.H. Roberts as the first one to make the connection between the church's policy toward blacks and the Book of Abraham. Was that what you were going to say? Yeah. I don't know the answer to that. I can't say that I've checked out the chronology on that enough to know. Bush argues that this connection was not made in the meetings of the 12 in the first presidency until about 1880. Certainly Roberts could have been implicated in that process, and he may have been the first one to suggest it. It's really important in all this race stuff to keep a historical context. I mean, I'm as embarrassed as anybody else about the history of racism in LDS tradition. But let's not forget that Abraham Lincoln, among others, said that there was no prospect for social equality between whites and blacks. Intermarriage should not take place. Blacks should not be enslaved, see, but being against slavery is one thing. It's not the same thing as being an egalitarian. Lincoln himself said that slavery was an evil, but nobody envisioned social equality for whites and blacks. In fact, when asked by, I think it was Horace Greeley, about what he was going to do with slavery in conducting the Civil War, Lincoln said, I'm not fighting the war to free the slaves. You know, if we can win the war without freeing any slaves, we'll do that. If we have to free them all to win the war, we'll do that. If we can win the war by freeing some and not others, we'll do that. That was Lincoln. Let's not forget these were 19th century Americans. Brigham Young was in the mainstream of white racial thinking in his day and age. And I think we oughtn't to forget that. Let's not also forget, if you'll forgive one more editorial, until the LDS Church changed its policy, it was quite unique in having a policy about prohibitions on holding the priesthood. But no other denominations either ever had more than minuscule numbers of blacks in their priesthood, except for the black denominations. Only they did it differently. What they did was they denied entrance of black applicants to seminaries, which is how you get ordained. We couldn't do that because we didn't have professional training seminaries. We had a lay priesthood, so we just had to make a blanket rule that no blacks could hold a priesthood. But if you go back and look at the numbers of clerics who are ordained ministers among the American Baptists, among the Methodists, among the Presbyterians, even among the Roman Catholics, you will find something like less than 1% of all of their clerics ever were given the priesthood. So, you know, it made us look bad because, first of all, we had a blanket rule about it. And second of all, we were so obstinate that we wouldn't give it up even when it, you know, it was obviously ridiculous. So, but again, context, I think, is really important. Yes?
We go back 60 years. That's got to be the basis.
Yeah. Actually, it doesn't say that anywhere. What it says is, in the book of Moses, it says that Enoch had a vision. And Enoch saw sometime in the future, not otherwise specified, that the descendants of Cain were black and had not place among the others. That in a vision that Enoch saw in 5th, 6th, 7th chapter of Moses. Then in the book of Abraham, it says the descendants of the Pharaoh were cursed as pertaining to the priesthood. Pharaoh was presumably a descendant of Ham, though it's not clear how this could happen. And it doesn't say that it had anything to do with race. It had to do with lineage. But we don't know what color the pharaohs were or what their race was, nor do we know anything about whatever got the pharaoh's lineage into trouble with the Lord, what relevance that had to today's black Africans. See? Well, it doesn't say that in the scriptures. But that's what... absolutely. But you see, what the church did here was what churches always do. When they have a policy, and this is what we did in this instance, you have, first of all, you got the policy. Now, you may, whatever your reasons are for the policy, you got to have some kind of theological rationale. What the brethren did was they took the policy and then offered a post hoc explanation for the policy, finding their warrant in these different scriptures. If you read those scriptures without ever knowing that the Mormons had this weird policy toward blacks, you won't see any of that in the scriptures. It's only after you already have the template and you take it back and impose it on these bits and pieces of scripture that you get the kind of rationale that then came to be church doctrine. And it was church doctrine. It was put out explicitly in a 1949 letter from the First Presidency. It's very strange, but that was there. You know, I wish that we would get more doctrinal articulation for church policies today. We don't have a doctrinal articulation for our position on abortion. We don't have a doctrinal articulation for our position on women in the priesthood. We don't have a doctrinal articulation for our position on gays. None of this has been given a theological rationale. We got church policies, and you can see, you know, if from a general kind of conservative social outlook, how those policies are consistent with such an outlook. But a theological rationale and articulation has never been offered for any of them, and I'd like to see one, even if it's misguided. yes, a sister here. I have no way to. I just have no way to answer that. I think there are, by implication at least, there are some theological obstacles to that. But I don't know what to predict about the church's position on any of those things. Certainly commonly held ideas, even by church leaders, are easier to change than canon doctrine.